everyone's doing well. I'm here this morning filling in for Tali Adler. I do not claim in any way to be able to actually reach the heights of Tali Adler or bring her unique perspective to it, but she's unable to be here this morning. So I am filling in and we'll do my best. You can report back to her and give your grade an assessment of how I did. But thrilled to be joining you in your Parsha and Midrash learning. And we're going to turn to a Midrash which Rav Tali selected and thought about and planned out. And I'm going to try to guide us through it and give some broader perspective of what's happening here. So, of course, we're in Parshat Bamidbar. I'm going to share my screen here to get us focused on the pasuk, the verse that is really the at the core of the Midrash. And I'll send over also the link to this so you can get in. And again, feel free, obviously, to use the chat as we go, either to offer some thoughts to one another or questions as I'm able to take as we go. I'm happy to engage. Okay, so we're at the beginning of a new sefer here. And we begin quite strikingly with dates, okay? If you think about the other books of the Torah, so far, do not begin with dates. Breshit, bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, what date could you even give there? We just begin by narrating the world. And we are then brought forward to Shmot. Breshit begins that way, and then Shmot begins with a list of names, but sort of out of time, been in Egypt for who knows how long. Vayikra, similarly, just begins with sort of a scene in Ohel Moed and a string of laws. But Bamidbar strikingly starts this way. Vaydaber Adonai al Moshe Bamidbar Sinai Be'ohel Moed, Be'echad lachodesh hasheni bashana hashenit, v'tzeita me'eretz Mitzrayim lemor. So we get a very, very specific date here, which is the first day of the month on the second month in the second year after they've come out of Egypt. So just sort of locating it in the timeline, right? They come out in the first day, in the 15th day of the first month, on the first year of the Exodus. So we are just a little over a year out here at the beginning of the second year and the second month. So the first thing we have here is dates, which is significant. The other thing which is significant, which we have had before, but is placed sort of with an unusual kind of double framing here is Bimidbar Sinai Be'ohel Moed. Okay, that's something else that's unusual, which is to say, you've got Bimidbar Sinai in a number of places. We just last week read Parshat Behar, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Behar Sinai Lemor at Mount Sinai. And, you know, Sefer Vayikra begins, Vayikra El Moshe Vayidaber Hashem Elav Me Ohel Moed Lemor, pegging that conversation between God and Moshe to the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting. But here we've got a double emphasis on the place. Bimidbar Sinai be'Ohel Moed. So our Midrash is going to pick up on the fact that there is an unusual specificity of place, and there is perhaps a striking specificity of date in this pasuk. And what is happening here at that specific moment? Se'u, et rosh kol adat b'nei Yisrael v'mishpachotam v'beit avotam, b'mispar shemot, kol zachar legulgalotam. That there should be a counting, idiomatically, of all the people, all the males of the Israelites, according to their families and their fathers' houses. But note that the verb here is se'u, which means to lift up, okay? Which is going to be also important in the Midrash here. One more thing about the date. The other thing that's striking about this date, which no doubt drew attention, is later on in Parshat Bamidbar, in Parshat Beha'alotcha, so 2 weeks from now, in the pretty well-known story of Pesach Sheni, which is that story when there's people who are impure at the time of the Pesach offering and they're unable to offer it, and they then ask for a second chance to come back. So that story, as you can imagine, plays out at the date of Pesach, at the date of Passover, which is, of course, in the first month on the 15th. And in fact, if you go to Bamidbar Numbers chapter 9, you will see that that story is given a date in Chodesh HaRishon, Bashana HaShenit, in the first month of the second year, as opposed to what we have here 8 chapters earlier on the second month. That is to say, this is a place where you are forced to acknowledge that the Torah is out of chronological order. It gives birth to the principle, Ein mukdam u'me'uchar ba'Torah. There is no necessary chronological order in the Torah. Huge debate between Rashi and Ramban in the Middle Ages, where Rashi takes that as license to jumble around all the different stories in the Torah and to tell you in all kinds of places, this one actually happened after that one, even though it comes first. Whereas Ramban says, no, this is the only place that happens. But one way or the other, the reader of the Torah is aware of the fact that this verse about the census is clearly out of chronological order with the rest of the Torah. And therefore, the specifying of the date here, Be'echad l'chodesh ha-sheni, b'shana ha-shenit, is all the more noteworthy and is going to catch the Darshan's eye in terms of it being worthy of comment. This date must have been pretty important to list it, even though it will confuse the reader as far as chronological order is concerned. Okay, so that's our background to move forward and to understand this. Just a few guiding questions here before we go into the Midrash that may help you kind of think about what is this Midrash picking up on from life. We're going to see what it's picking up on from politics and the surrounding culture at the time, but what's sort of the emotional valence that this Midrash is trying to get at? And to think about why dates matter, both dates and locations, right? Why do those matter? Births, weddings, all kinds of other life cycle events. Like, why do we mark anniversaries, right? I mean, who cares on some level? It's not happening now. What is it that marking things in some cyclical way pegged to a date matters? What does it mean to have places that you go back to and say, oh, this happened here, even though that event is not happening right now? Like, I have one place I've been back to a couple times in my life, the top of Bear Mountain in Connecticut, where once on a camping trip, an overnight trip with camp, makes the heart heavy to talk about camp these days. I was with a group of people and we were actually struck by lightning on that hike. We all were fine, but it was a crazy event. And the couple times where I've gone back to that spot, even though it's a nice, bright, clear, sunny day, there's something very intense about going there. But why, right? What is the sort of emotional purpose of attaching meaning to date and place? And then this second question of, how do you imagine events are different when they're given a concrete date and place, right? That is to say, think about the other things in the Torah that don't get a date, or the other books of the Torah that don't begin with a date and a place. What's the emotional valence of Bereshit and Shemot, you know, in that regard? What's the, you know, sort of historical consciousness piece of just sort of finding the Israelites enslaved in Egypt, but without having a particular date? It's sort of out of time. That obviously has a peg of a place, other than, as opposed to, you know, something that says this happened here at that moment. Or you think about the creation of the world, or Gan Eden, how the Garden of Eden, it's like, yeah, given some geographical coordinates, but it's very unclear exactly where it is. What's the difference of encountering memories of that sort? Okay, with that, we're going to jump into this Midrash from Bamidbar Rabbah. Bamidbar Rabbah is a kind of later collection of Midrashim, so some of its things are already early medieval. as opposed to some of the other midrashim like Bereshit Rabbah and Vayikra Rabbah that are much earlier and hail mainly from the Amoraic period. Okay, so here we go. Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe b'midbar Sinai, our opening verse, pegging this communication to the Sinai wilderness. Zehu she'amar ha-katub lo asachen l'chol goy, v'chein v'yarem keren le'amo. This is sort of captured, referenced by, alluded to, by two verses that are in Psukei Dezimra, in the morning collection of Psalms, said daily. First, the statement that there was something that God did not do for any other nation. Lo asachen l'chol goy, only for Israel. And in the immediate following Psalm, Vayarem keren le'amo, God lifted up a horn for his nation, but in the sort of idiomatic way of saying elevated and promoted them. Okay, so there's something distinctive that's been done for Israel that was not done for others. And now we're going to get a mashal, a parable. Mashal melech shenatal isha rishona velo chatav la ktuba, gersha velo chatav la get, kach la shnia vela shlishit. So we've got a king who basically finds women who he likes, who he wants to be with, who he wants to marry, who he wants to be intimate with. Not clear what the nature of the relationship is here, but what is clear is that the nature of the sort of contract between them, the nature of the or I should say this way, if the nature of the attraction or the motivation is not clear, the nature of the relationship in terms of how it's defined is clear, there's no real structure around it. He does not write this first woman a ketubah, that is to say, he does not take financial responsibility for the relationship. And when he divorces her, he doesn't write her a bill of divorce. And the sense here seems to be there was no need to do so, because there was never really any kind of permanence to the relationship. And so too he did with a second and a third wife. Ella me'asa, but then what happened? Ra'a aniya yetoma bat avot. He then sees a poor orphan, and not orphan necessarily in the sense of, you know, a young child, but there's no parents here. This person is alone, vulnerable. But she is a bat avot. She is descended from great, significant people. Bikesh li tolota. And then he wanted to marry her or take her, depending on how you translate that verb, li tol. Amar le shoshvino. He said to one of his attendants, a shoshvin is also like a groomsman, so it's someone who's sort of assisting him in the marriage process. Al tinhag bakarishonot. This one, don't arrange the marriage or the connection in the same way as with the earlier women. Zobat avoti. This is a descendant of significant people. Tznu'ahi b'ma'aseha uchshera. Moreover, she is modest and appropriate in her deeds, and she is fit, she is worthy. Uchtov la ketuba. And I want you to write her a ketuba. I want you to write her a marriage document. Be'eza shavua, be'ezo shana, be'eza chodesh, be'chama b'chodesh, be'ezo iparchia. Write a ketubah in exactly the way a ketubah is still written until today. You know, what week of the month, what shavua here means the sabbatical year cycle. So, you know, in which sabbatical year cycle are they getting married? In which year of that cycle? In which month? And what day of the month? Okay? In other words, give a very specific set of dates that make clear when this ketubah is taking effect. This is, of course, in general required. Why do ketubahs have to have dates? Well, fundamentally, because if what ketubot are about is about a setting up a debt, right? Financial obligation for the husband, you always have to have dates on documents of debt, so you know who has precedence to collect when there's limited resources, right? It's like if I take on an obligation on the first of Nisan, so that obligation is prior to an obligation I took on the first of Iyar. But here, it's being indicated as a sign of taking the relationship and the commitment more seriously. okay? Not just sort of the technical piece of it, of when to collect, but we are really sort of wanting to nail down, this is important, says the king. I want it really properly documented. And what's our proof of this, right? And so that's the time. And then be'ezo iparchia, iparchia, the Greek word for a region, a district, okay? A certain area of territory that's under like a regional governor. And just like, again, the ketubah has a date and a city, right, that it's written in. Go ahead and do that. Keshem shekatuv be'ester, the proof that this is the way that serious royal marriages are documented, you see from the pasuk, "Vatilakach Esther al Melech Achashverosh al Beit Malchuto b'Chodesh Asiri u'Chodesh Tevet b'Shnat Shev al Malchuto." A lot of dates, right? It's in the 10th month. I'll tell you the name of the month. I'm telling you the year of reign. There's something very, very significant in the time stamp here, as it were. That's what the king says in the mashal. All right, now we're going to get to the nimshal. How is this like our story, and how will it bring us back to our pasuk? Kach HaKadosh Baruch Hu bara ledor ha-mabul velo chatav ve-matai bra'an. So too, the generation of the flood was created, and it's never written when they were created. Meaning, Sefer Breshit does not begin with dates, right? You don't actually get any date about anything that happens in those early years in that first generation. He'eviran min ha'olam velo katave matai he'eviran. They were removed from the world, wiped out, and the date of them being wiped out is not given. Ela, the closest you get is, okay. There are dates of when Noah is going into the ark. There's dates when the rain starts, but there's not actually a date that is given for the purposes of saying, and on such and such date, you know, they all died. Okay. So there's a sense of God forged an initial connection with humanity. There's no date attached to it, and then God wipes out that connection, and there's no date attached to it, just like back in the Mashal, lo chatav la ktuba and lo chatav la get. There is no date assigned to the consummation of the relationship and no date assigned to its dissolution. V'chein ledor aflaga, and so too to the generation of the dispersion, that is to say, the whole story of Migdal Bavel, there's no date there of when the nations are scattered and when that experiment that begins with Noah begins to fail. V'chein la'mitzrim, lo haya kotev ve'matay nivre'u ve'matay metu. And the Egyptians, the arch enemies, the most significant people, you would think maybe the Torah would have told the story on such and such date, Paro ascended to the throne. On such and such date, they drowned at the sea. No, the Torah does not break into the narrative to give it a character of being rooted in place, being rooted in time in those cases. Ela, kevan shamdu Yisrael, only when Israel comes onto the scene, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, eini noheg be'elu keotan harishonim. So now the mashal is being filled out. The shoshvin, the groomsman, the assistant to the king is Moshe. Of course, the king is God. And the rishonim, the earlier women in the Mashal, are essentially the earlier chapters of humanity. And then it is the moment of Israel, where God sees, who are clearly understood to be a poor people, right? You'll remember that part of the Mashal, a poor orphaned woman. There's a poor orphaned people who are basically, right, enslaved in Egypt and being taken out. But they are different because they are B'nai Avot. They are the descendants of significant, important, and great men, B'nai Avraham, Yitzhak, Ve'Yaakov. All right? They're the children of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Therefore, says God, for these ones, I want you to handle it differently. Lech k'tov lahem, be'ezechodesh, bechama bachodesh. ובאיזו שנה, באיזו היפרחיה, ובאיזה עיר רוממתי קרנם ונתתי להם תלוי ראש. I want you to write the month, the day of the month, the year, the region, and the city in which I lifted them up and gave them literally a hanging head, but the sense of sort of an elevated head, elevated stature. Lechach ne'emar. This is why this verse is so strange and detailed and unusual and perhaps unexpected for the start of a book of the Torah. Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe b'midbar Sinai, the wilderness of Sinai, that's the Iparchia, that's the region. Be'ol Moed, hare Medina. Ol Moed is the province. Medina we think of today as like a country or a state, but Medina is much smaller. It's like a Roman province that's basically contained within a region. All right, so you've got Midbar Sinai is the larger region. Ohel Moed is the Medina, or even, you know, the year, as it said earlier. Bashana Hashenit, there you got the year, the second year. Bachodesh Hasheni, there you got the month, the second month. Be'echad Lachodesh, there you've got the date of the month, the first. Hare Nichteva Opateya. All right, now this is a reference actually to Roman bureaucracy. So Opateya is the Greek word Hupateya, which is the Greek equivalent of the Roman consul, like from our word consulate, consular officer. Roman consuls were elected 2 per year to serve initially as actual real governors of Rome, but later on they were sort of, by the time of later rabbinic midrashim, they were sort of symbolic figures, but whose names were used in the official dating of all kinds of records. You would say in such and such year of the emperor, in the year of the consul, you know, so-and-so, and the consul so-and-so. So this Hare Nichteva Opateya is sort of saying, this is our version. This verse is our version of what you may have encountered if you've ever seen a Roman document, where things that they think are really important, they make sure to specify with all of these dates and all of these components. In that sense, we can take this midrash as saying what we know from sort of broader Roman culture and bureaucracy and see from the inside of what we know about what that signifies in terms of importance. This verse is actually fundamentally telling us, oh, God really cares what's happening here. And a great, great comment here that Shmot chapter 19 also begins with this, B'chodesh HaShlishi Letzeit B'nei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim, right? The scene of the giving of the Torah is similarly prefaced by that kind of move. Why? Why all this effort to be very clear about the dates and about the place? Se'u et rosh kol adat b'nei Yisrael. Lekayem ma she'ne'emar. Lekayem ma she'ne'emar. Lo asachen lechol goy. U'me'asa v'yarem keren le'amo. This lifting up of the heads of B'nai Yisrael, which of course idiomatically means to count, but is the verb of lifting up, is what is alluded to of lo asachen lichol goy. Something was done for Israel here that was not done for any other nation. And that was this kind of specifying of the time, the place and date of Vayarem Keren Le'amo, the place of lifting up the people, which never happened in any of the other narratives. Okay, that's the Midrash. Now, there's obviously a very heavy element, and you could even argue sort of maybe central and defining element here, that is sort of about a Jewish-Gentile, conflict, a kind of parochial Jewish reading of history. And that's, I think, all very real in terms of the historical background of the Midrash and this comment of it's saying we count. There's something, I think, undeniably defensive here in an appropriate and understanding way, a people that feels that in certain ways it's been left behind by history. It's not really running the empires. It doesn't have the ability to produce all kinds of official documents that can be put out and sort of define time for the rest of the world, right? Even today, we're trapped in 2020, which is not a date that has anything to do with our reckoning or anything significant that ever happened to the Jewish people. And there's a sense here of, well, I'll show you our reckoning and our date, and I'll show you how God actually cares about our timeline more than anything else in the world. So that's clearly, I think, for any historical understanding of this Midrash, central. But I think the piece here that, you know, I want to leave you with, and I know that Rav Tali really was focused on here, is, okay, move beyond the Israel-Gentile split here. The Midrash is also containing a kind of deeper insight of, we have relationships and encounters with people and events in life, and sometimes we mark them very carefully, and we have very clear dates about what happens, date and place. And then other times we live in spaces where it's not that way. We live sort of in more of a blur of time and space. And what does that do to those experiences and to us? You know, it's hard not to have everything be about COVID-19 when you're in these spaces. But I do think one of the things that's very striking to me, if I reflect personally on sort of the recent weeks, is I am highly defined by place in the sense that I'm mostly at home. But what that actually means is that that has become a much less significant variable. That is to say, in a way that in a normal week, I might retrack the week by saying, I was in these seven different places. And I can really sort of tell the story of my week. Like on Monday, I went into the office. On Tuesday, I had this meeting. On Wednesday, I got to go for a walk with this person to this place. That is much more of a blur. I am more disproportionately in one place than I ever have. And time, accordingly, I find blurs, as I'm sure many of you do. Like, do you always remember, if it weren't for my getting up every morning and davening and saying the Shir Shel Yom, that today is Yom Chamishi, I'm not sure I know Thursday from Wednesday anymore. And the ways in which you live in a different frame of mind when you are not marking time and space in the same way. Now, in this Midrash, that's unambiguously bad. I don't think that always is, right? I gave the example of Gan Eden. There are things that are out of place and out of time that can create a kind of magical, mythical environment. Some of the most amazing times in life, I think, can sometimes come when we don't remember actually all the details. We just have a vague sense of having been in a state of elation or depression or confusion for some period of time. But it is different. Whether it is better or worse, it is dramatically different. And this Midrash, I think, is reminding us that putting dates and places to things actually changes the event. So when you revisit a birthday, an anniversary, you have a chag on the calendar of Shavuot that comes around year after year. By doing it year after year and by marking the date, you actually imbue it with a different significance. It's not just putting a pin on it and remembering it. It defines a different kind of relationship. And the message that this Midrash is saying is God, by choosing to record very clearly a date and a place, actually ends up affecting and defining the sort of nature and permanence of our relationship, the relationship between God and the Jewish people. So the thought for going into Parsha Bamidbar, and for this dateless and timeless time, which hopefully we're going to begin to move out of shortly. I hope you have a wonderful rest of the week and a Shabbat Shalom. Thanks so much for hosting me in this space. And Rav Tali will be back with you on Monday. It was a pleasure to learn with you.